From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. Well, this morning we talk about the reality of alien life and the challenges of finding it with astrophysicist Adam Frank. He's the author of The Little Book of Aliens. We'll see if we can actually dispel my fear of alien abduction. Then we talk with Dr. Lauren Bergenheyer. She's an associate professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. She talks about the potential of extracting rare earth elements from existing coal mines. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Aliens have been depicted in a variety of ways, from little gray creatures with big eyes sucking you into their spaceship to terrifying monsters with acid for blood preying on unsuspecting space travelers. But what is the reality of other life in the universe? Where are these aliens and why haven't we found them yet? And have they really found us? Well, here to talk about the reality of alien life and the challenges of finding it is astrophysicist Adam Frank, author of The Little Book of Aliens and a professor of physics and astronomy at University of Rochester. Adam, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It is a pleasure to be talking to you both again.
All right. Why is it, this is a horrible pun, have aliens abducted our collective psyche?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because so much of it, everything starts in the 1950s, basically. The first UFO report is actually late 40s. And then, you know, the space race sort of begins in the 50s, the rocketry, nuclear weapons. I think there's a whole set of circumstances that lead to the idea of aliens, alien life, possibly visiting or just out there, and the possibilities of human beings contacting aliens. And, you know, of course, Hollywood, you know, recognizes, a chance to make money when they can. And it's in the early 50s that you get this preponderance of B movies, both B and actually much better movies. There are some that were really big budget films for the time. And that's, I think, when the aliens abducted, when they invaded and took root in our heads. And they haven't left since. And so, you know, we're full of these sort of cultural imaginings of aliens, including horrific ones, right? There was a horror aspect to aliens that got embedded then. And the interesting thing about those 1950s, just to conclude, is that was when actually astrobiology was beginning. That was the decade when the first true scientific efforts to think about life beyond the universe began.
Well, a full disclosure, this is sort of a therapy session for me because we were joking earlier that I actually have this weird, completely unfounded fear of alien abduction. Maybe it was growing up in Vernal in the Eastern Uinta Basin where there were stories of Bigfoot and aliens. So yes, y'all get to join into my therapy session about aliens. Well,
how do you feel about your feelings?
God, it's still unnerving. I can't look at aliens, little green men, without covering my eyes. That's how I feel about them. But how have the ancients felt about them? Because you look at all these petroglyphs from around southern Utah and other areas, and they don't all look human on those petroglyphs. And you talk in your book about the ancient Greek and Catholic and Roman discussions about alien life. How did this really get started, short of movies in the 50s? It seems like the idea of aliens has been permeating our culture for decades and eons.
Well, the question of is there life in the universe beyond Earth is certainly an ancient one. And as I talk about in the book, you can see in the writings of Aristotle and Democritus, them going after each other, so to speak, because they had such different ideas. So throughout history, people have asked this question. And the reason why is the stars, right? The stars, we all feel the weight of the question under when we stand under the stars. What are they? What is out there? And once, you know, people recognized very early that some of those stars, a few of them, are planets, are wanderers. And it was, you know, by the time of the Greeks, it was recognized that these were bodies that were, you know, at the time they thought they were moving around the Earth. But it was recognized that there were other objects moving around out there in space. And so the question of are those like us? Are those bodies like the Earth and that do they have life? was quickly realized. And then you see this sort of formal argumentation about it, starting with the Greeks and then going on pretty much every century. In every century, every generation, somebody has been arguing about whether or not there's life elsewhere. You know, and you get to the Renaissance and you see Giordano Bruno being burned at the stake by the Catholic Church, not directly for his views about aliens, but indirectly. He believed there were other planets with other life. So it's an ancient question that, you know, people have been arguing over with, like, just their opinions, man, forever. And what is amazing, and that's for the point of, you know, I wanted to write the little book of aliens, is to let people understand that we are the first generation that's going to get an answer, right? I don't know exactly what the answer is going to be, but we finally have the telescopic technology to probe life on other distant worlds.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with astrophysicist Adam Frank, and he has written the Little Book of Aliens, and he's joining us today to give us sort of a primer, really. This is a historical survey, isn't it, Adam? And, you know, to bring us, I feel like it is a primer for those of us who maybe haven't been paying attention, because, as you say, we are the first generation that is really going to, well, according to you, find out what's really out there. I always think it's interesting when I read about Fermi's paradox. For example, you know, it took this nuclear physicist, Enrico Fermi, to say something that seems so simple. Well, there's not really evidence, but surely there is intelligent life out there. And of course, it gets much more complicated, but that's the basis of it. Can you talk about, I guess it's bringing us forward into, you know, the 50s and Fermi's paradox?
Yeah, that's why the 50s are so important. Fermi's paradox is one of these initial formulations of the problem that happens in the 1950s, right? So there's Fermi's paradox, there's the first experiments about abiogenesis, about forming life. And then by the end of that decade, there's the first actual astrobiological experiment with the first SETI search. So what Fermi did is over lunch, this happened actually over lunch, he and some scientists at Los Alamos were talking about the possibilities of life in the universe. And then, you know, they kind of went on to other subjects. Then an hour later, like when lunch was ending, he said, well, where are they? And what he realized was that even one intelligent civilization that develops interstellar travel, even slow interstellar travel, could hop from one planet to the other or one star system to the other in the galaxy in a relatively short time compared to the age of the galaxy. It takes about 600,000 years to cover the entire galaxy, moving in a tenth of the speed of light. And what he was saying was, well, listen, if intelligent life is common and everybody builds spaceships, why aren't they here already? And that's what's called Fermi paradox. There's another version that has grown out of that, which is, well, listen, we've been looking since 1960 with SETI, with radio telescopes. Why haven't we found any? That's also sometimes, I call that the indirect Fermi paradox. Now, the important thing to understand is that second one doesn't exist, you know, because people think that, you know, every night astronomers are out looking for life with radio telescopes, and we've been doing it since 1960. But the sad fact is there was never any money to do SETI searches. Radio telescopes are hard to come by. They don't just give them out for free. And SETI was always kind of a marginal field. So we really haven't looked. The sky is uncharted when it comes to looking for intelligent life. And it's only now, finally, that astrobiology is really one of the main concerns of astronomy, that we're gonna go looking for life. So Fermi's paradox, I like to say there is no Fermi paradox, certainly that indirect version of it.
Okay, so let's talk about the money that's being poured into it now. NASA, I think it was 2019 maybe, gave sort of an unprecedented grant to a group of scientists to kind of explore this with Adam Frank, you at the, I'll say the helm, but that might be only in my mind, you at the helm.
Well, so what happened was, so SETI, so we want to think about astrobiology in general, but also the idea of looking for intelligent life. Because what happened was, it was in 1995 that for the first time, after 2,500 years of people asking the question about planets, are there any other planets orbiting other stars, right? Because all we knew of were the eight planets that orbit the sun, and no one had ever discovered a planet orbiting another star. And since we think planets are essential for forming life, if planets were rare, life would be rare. Well, in 1995, we discovered the first exoplanet. That's the term we use, the first planet orbiting another star. Within 20 years, we know that every star in the sky hosts a family of worlds, and many of those worlds, many of those planets are in the right place for life to form, what we call the habitable zone. So, you know, NASA started pumping money into astrobiology and the search for dumb life, like microbial life, biospheres. But it was still, SETI was still kind of like, you know, for reasons that we can talk about, it was still kind of marginal. And NASA was not funding the search for intelligent life. And in 2019, a group that I was the principal investigator of this, it's a group of us. I just happen to be the one whose, you know, name is at the top of the grant. We actually got the first funding from NASA to study what is called technosignatures, right? So biosignatures would be the signature of a biosphere in the light from a distant star. Technosignatures are the search of tech, or the signature or imprint of technology in the light from a distant star. So our program, now we've gotten renewed already. We've already, you know, we've had this grant now for almost 5 years. We're about to try and renew it again. We have been making great progress in understanding how you might find intelligent life on a planet that is, you know, 40 light years away, a planet you're never gonna visit. So it's been really transformative to have this kind of science in play.
So Adam, what will those techno signatures look like? You know, a lot of us have these visions of you're going to see a planet with city lights or possibly some sort of radio beam coming off of the planet, like basically looking at a mirror image of ourselves. But I'm imagining there's probably a much broader scope of what these techno signatures entail.
Yeah, that is a great question. And the purpose of our grant is actually to build a library of these techno signatures. We have to systematically go through, you know, all of the suggestions for the last 40 years, many of which, you know, don't go anywhere, come up with new suggestions, and then investigate them scientifically, do the theoretical study to say, like, well, actually, could you see this with a telescope like James Webb? And so a great example is, for example, chlorofluorocarbons, what we might think of as atmospheric pollution, right? So, you know, either on purpose or by accident, a technological civilization might, you know, put chemicals into the atmosphere, chemicals that there's no way that nature on its own would produce. And the question is, can we see those from across interstellar distances? And we now have a list of them, including things like nitrous dioxide, chlorofluorocarbons, which are the industrial chemical that we used for air conditioning and actually was kind of eating up the ozone, so we had to limit its use. So those, and city lights also, city lights as well. So we now actually have quite a list of things that we could take a big telescope like James Webb Space Telescope or the what's going to follow from it, look at the planet, and then be able to see in the light the signature of those chemicals or of those city lights, and that will tell us there's a civilization there.
Well, you brought up the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope inadvertently, and we've been talking with them, and I know that one of their missions is to look for exoplanets. Will you and your team be partnering with them?
Well, that telescope won't be powerful enough to look for signatures, because in order to look for biosignatures or technosignatures, you need a big honking telescope that can gather up so much light, because you need a lot of light, you need a lot of photons from these planets to get the spectral signature, to get the fingerprint in the light of, you know, either a biosphere or a technosphere. So the James Webb Space Telescope is just on the hairy edge of being able to do this. We might get lucky with James Webb and get either a biosignature or a technosignature. It's the next generations of telescope, these 30-meter telescopes that are being built on the ground, things that have mirrors the size of a football field, or that, you know, this really tells you where the state of the field is. The next giant telescope that NASA is going to build, the replacement for JWST, is something that's going to be called the Habitable Worlds Observatory. It's right there in the name, right? So what's amazing is SETI or astrobiology in the 1950s was considered kind of fringe. Who's going to do that? And now it's the frontiers of science. I mean, the search for life in the universe, dumb life or smart life, is considered so important that we're going to be pumping all of our resources in the astronomical community to build a telescope that's tuned to answer that question.
We're speaking with Adam Frank. He's talking about his book, The Little Book of Aliens. Adam, we live in the age of conspiracy theories and disinformation. And I'm wondering if, I know that lawmakers are starting to pressure the government. There have been bills presented, and I don't know exactly where they are. You can fill us in on government transparency, about what the government knows that we don't about UFOs or whatever we're calling them these days, UAPs. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this story of life in the universe, there's the science and then there's UFOs and UAPs, right? And they sort of evolved together, as I talked about. And one of the things that really killed SETI, killed funding for SETI in the 80s and 90s was as politicians attaching it to UFOs in order to make political hay, to make, you know, score political points. So, you know, recently, starting in 2017, there was these Navy videos that were released as part of a New York Times article about a Pentagon program to study unidentified aerial phenomena, which was just a rebranding of UFOs. And since then, there's been a lot of, you know, talk about, you know, the government has sightings of unidentified objects. They need to be, there should be a transparent, open scientific investigation of them, which I fully support. And then, of course, there was the very, how should we say, contentious testimony by one guy in particular, former intelligence operative, who said that, like, oh, the government has spaceships in garages. So let me just give you this as an astronomer who's very interested in life in the universe, my take on UAPs. And there's not a whole lot of there when it comes to the evidence. You know, what we have is, you know, 70 years of fuzzy blob photos and personal testimony. And there's just not, as a scientific investigation, you can't really go very far on these. Like, I'm very happy that the pilots can come forward now without stigma and talk about what they've seen. But, you know, you can't use personal testimony to make the most amazing conclusion ever, which is that we're being visited by aliens. And what's interesting is, these government reports, which, you know, recently, the ones that Congress mandated, what they've shown is what we've always known, is that when you start looking at these reports, 95% of them are explainable, right? It turns out, like, oh, it's balloons, or it's a drone, or it's, you know, Venus, or it's, and this is what this has always been the case. So 95% of all unexplained reports of UAPs, UFOs, are explainable. The sky is not full of unexplained stuff. Now you've got that 5% or so that are unexplained. Some of them are unexplained because there's just not even enough data to begin trying to explain something. Somebody saying to you, like, oh, I saw something over a cow field. It's like, do you have a picture? No, but I saw something. It's like, there's not much I can do with that. And then there are a few, there's always a handful that are freaky deaky, you know? But that doesn't mean that they are, you can use that to conclude we're being visited by aliens. So I think the end result here is that it would be good to do a transparent, open, agnostic investigation of UAPs, and let's see where the science leads. So that's kind of where I stand. If I could just say one last thing, which is the whole UFOs or spaceships in a garage, come on, show me the spaceship. Like, that is just such a radical, you know, hypothesis. And people have been saying this, by the way, since like 1950s. There's always been some guy in the military who publishes a book who says, yeah, the government's got them, but they're not telling you. And it's kind of like circular, you know, these guys are talking to other guys in the government who believe this. And even the head of the government program that was investigating this said, this is a real problem. You've got people in the intelligence and military who, without evidence, have this kind of religion about UFOs. And he said, you know, some of these people should have their security clearances denied because they're not working rationally. So I just don't hold a lot to those. I'm all for transparency, let's do it. But I don't think much is gonna come out of that based on the history.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And as you were talking, it made me wonder about this bridge between science fiction and science, and knowing that, you know, someone like you, from the time you were a little boy, you ate up, you devoured science fiction, and then you became an astrophysicist. So can you just talk a little bit about that bridge between, you know, most astrophysicists start off with this insatiable desire to, you know, to consume science fiction.
Do we have like 10 hours to nerd out? It's like, where do we want to start? Yeah, I think science fiction for me has played an enormous role. And some of my most important ideas, the ones that I, you know, had the most fun pursuing, came from reading science fiction. I often, especially when it comes to aliens, I think in that there's a certain way in which these storytellers, right, they're professional storytellers, can do a better job at articulating the directions that an alien mind, an alien civilization might go, better than, you know, a bunch of astronomers who are trained in astronomy, not trained in anthropology or history or other domains. So I feel that there's a really important link between science fiction and this kind of science, because to think about aliens, you know, think about alien life of any kind, whether it's just, you know, biospheres or intelligent technospheres, technosphere building species, you've got to imagine what you've never imagined before. And you may even have to imagine the unimaginable, right? And that requires a wider imaginative space than just physics is going to give you. And, you know, because you need to meld physics and biology and cognitive science and then storytelling, you know, I think science fiction is really, really important. And, you know, if we had time, I could go through the things, the books, the shows that I think have really been useful for pushing our conception of the alien forward.
All right, well, let's go there. We still have a few more minutes. What would be your favorite movie and book that really does show or help explain what alien life could look like?
The first one would be a movie, which is Arrival, which I think is the best contact movie ever made. The great thing about that movie is they send in two people. One is a Carl Sagan-like physicist, like, you know, someone like me, who's going to translate the alien language using math, because everybody uses math. And that fails spectacularly. And the other person they send in is a linguist who understands that language is always embodied. Language is not some abstraction. It's something. It's a lived construction. And she's the one who makes contact with them. And then they realize that they're experiencing the world entirely different. Their time moves different. They move through time differently than we do. So that's number one. It's just a beautiful movie too. And then the other, my favorite book, even though I don't agree with some of its premises, is Blind Sight by, I think it's Peter Wells. I'm not really sure. You'll have to look it up. Blind Sight. And it is a contact movie where, you know, I'm going to give a little away here, is that the premise is about self-consciousness, about whether or not does intelligence require self-consciousness? Does there have to be someone in there self-aware? And it is a really imaginative book and terrifying in its conception. And so those are just two, there's lots more, but those are two examples of things that really helped me kind of think about how should I think about alien minds and the possibility of evolution of alien life forms.
Well, let's end this on a philosophical question. You know, it's easy to talk about aliens and its like possibility of life, but we've been living on this planet without any, you know, true evidence. What happens to our collective mindset when that discovery is made, when you guys find your technosignatures or a biomarker? That changes everyone's perspective. And I would imagine that's going to be a massive philosophical shift here on planet Earth.
I would agree. I would say, I'd like to bring up a little thing called the Copernican Revolution, right? You know, in 1200, everybody woke up and said, oh, look, the sun's, the sun's rising. And then 400 years later, everybody woke up and said, oh, look, it's the horizon rolling down, because we realized that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. The sun was the center of the solar system, and the Earth was just one more planet. And, you know, the Copernican Revolution is actually implicated in the Enlightenment, in the Renaissance, in the Protestant Reformation, in the birth of industrial economies. Like, that shift actually, it seems like, oh, it's just astronomy, who cares? It played a role in the absolute reshaping of human culture. Finding alien life would be the Copernican revolution times a billion, right? It would just utterly reorient who we think we are, where we think we are, how we're connected to life and the planet and other planets. I think it would be, because it would show, see, life is so different than non-life. Like, you know, there's no other system like life in the universe. Black holes are interesting, rocks are interesting, but nothing creates and innovates the way life does. Life is open-ended in its history. So that means if we're not a one-off, if we're not a cosmic accident and there's other life, even finding one, that will show us that there's a lot of life out there. And then we're part of a cosmic community of evolutionary innovators. And where has that gone? How far can that go? The possibilities are literally endless. And so I think it'll change everything.
Well, our guest today has been Adam Frank. He is an astrophysicist, a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Rochester, and the author of a great book called The Little Book of Aliens. And Adam, I think you've mostly dissuaded some of my fears of alien abduction, but I still think they're creepy looking.
Well, good
Adam,
luck.
Yeah, thanks. I've been dealing with it for a long time. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio once again.
It was a pleasure. Thank you both.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Lately, the news of rare earth element extraction has been focused on extraction in areas previously untouched, meaning that even more earth will have to be moved and mined to gain access to these crucial metals. But what if rare earth elements could be extracted from mines that have already been moving rock, where the infrastructure is developed and the land already disturbed? Well, researchers from the University of Utah are studying the feasibility and potential of extracting rare earth elements from existing coal mines. Joining us to talk about this new potential source is Dr. Lauren Bergenheyer, Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. Lauren, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks. Really glad to be here.
Well, to get started, remind us and our listeners how coal is formed.
Great question. So coal is actually formed in ancient peat swamps. Often, as you can kind of think about today, you think about coastal swamps as areas where peat accumulates. And so that happens in millions of years ago too. And then over a long period of time, that peat swamp gets buried, and over successive layers of sediment gets buried deeper and deeper. It gets put under heat and pressure, and that transfers the peat into actual coal, what we call coalification. And depending on how sort of deep it's buried and how long it's buried, it can become different types of coal. So we have different coal ranks. Here in Utah, most of the coal is bituminous, which is a particular type of coal that's been buried.
And then in the papers that I've been reading about, you, and we'll go into this further, but you talk about how there's the potential for rare earth elements in the layers of shale above and below. Now, how do those form? Do they form a cap, like a protective layering, if you will, around the coal seams?
Yeah, so you can kind of think of a peat swamp today. Maybe you could think of like the Everglades or some sort of swampy area near the coast. And there's other types of environments around it too, right? Where maybe a little bit of mud might get accumulated in that peat swamp. That mud then later turns into shale. Or you can think about maybe a little river that comes through the peat swamp and it gets filled with sand. And then that later becomes sandstone. So these peat swamps are sort of dynamic environments where different types of sediment are deposited. And so, yeah, often you will find shales adjacent to the coal seams.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Lauren Bergenheyer. She's the Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. We're talking to her today about the possibility of finding rare earth elements in coal mines. So in Utah here, Lauren, I believe our energy portfolio has been, and I don't know if it's shifted much since the onset of cleaner energies, but 80% is our energy portfolio coal? Is that, does that sound about right? Or have we?
I would put it a bit lower, probably maybe somewhere near 60 or 70%, but that's my guess. Yeah.
Okay. And coal mines are going away. A lot of coal mines have been closed already in Utah and beyond. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I think I know why that is, but maybe you can talk a little more about that.
Yes, you're right. There is an overall downtrend. Coal mines are closing across the country, and that is largely, due to environmental pressures. We definitely want to mitigate carbon emissions, and there are more clean energy technologies that are coming on board that are sort of our future as a net zero emissions future. It's definitely a really important goal. And one thing, so coal mines have sort of been on the decline. Interestingly, here in Utah, demand the last several years has been quite high. So we're sort of in this space of wanting to move towards cleaner technologies, but still using a lot of energy, right, as a society, and still needing that coal base. So it's a bit of an interesting time in terms of the economics and the energy transition and how that's occurring.
Yeah, really interesting. In Park City, we've had this big goal of reducing our carbon footprint, and I just heard, really unfortunately, from someone who's very involved in sustainability here, that in the last, since we made that declaration, our carbon footprint has increased by almost 30%. Or is it, maybe I'm exaggerating. I might have heard 22%, but whatever the numbers are, yeah, the demand isn't going away. And so as we look towards cleaner technologies, we also are learning how many of them are not clean, and they're not clean for various reasons, and there is a big human cost. We're hearing a lot about the cobalt mines in the DRC and Congo. So we know that we need to, however, try to stick with cleaner energies because it is our future, like you say. Yeah. But what do you see as a geophysicist that we're lacking?
Yeah, so my perspective as a geoscientist is you've hit it right on. The world is not black and white in terms of how we get our energy, right? We like to think about there are these clean energy solutions that are completely clean and free of carbon and free of environmental impact. And then there are fossil fuels like oil and gas and coal that are dirty and have a lot of emissions. However, it's not that simple, right? We all definitely want a clean energy future. But a lot of the clean energy technologies, they rely on extractive industries, on mining, right? We have to mine these things to make wind turbines, to make solar panels, to make things, different magnets in our hybrid vehicles, right? So in some ways, you're sort of switching out, there's a cost plus benefit analysis here. And so the reality is we have to get these critical minerals in order to build a clean energy future, and it relies on mining. And often it currently relies on, international sources for these. They're really not being mined domestically in any large abundance. And so there is an aspect of environmental justice to this as well, to think about in terms of how to transition into an energy future. And sort of one of the sweet spots of what we've been doing is, recognizing the sort of complexity of that challenge and saying, what is a way that, really wins here in terms of our energy needs? And one is to really explore ways that coal could diversify in terms of their economic model and how it could actually serve our transition into the clean energy future.
Lauren, you were just part of the team that came out with a paper in April entitled Rare Earth Element Enrichment in Coal and Coal Adjacent Strata of the Uinta Region, Utah and Colorado. Basically meaning you are looking for the possibilities of rare earth elements being found in existing coal mines. And in my reading, it's not in the coal. Where is it?
It's actually generally what we're seeing is it's above and below the coal seams. In shales that tend to, these black shales that tend to be above and the coal, below the coal seams. So it's not to say, so we would definitely need innovative mining technologies to move that out. It wouldn't be sort of what the coal mines are doing right now. We'd have to innovate on that. And then we'd need to understand the best mineral separation processing technology as well. However, you know, innovating on mining is something that traditional hard rock mines like Kennecott and Rio Tinto, they do all the time. And so I think there's a potential future there.
Now, I know that your research was done on the Uinta coal seam. Did I get that right? So that's very much, you know, here in the West. Is that the only area that's being looked at for these potential rare earth elements? Or is anywhere else in the world either one extracting rare earth elements already or doing the same sort of research?
Yeah, this is a great question. So we've been looking at different coal seams across what's called the Uinta region, which is Utah and Western Colorado, all of the active mines. And each mine mines a different seam. So it's a different sort of scenario everywhere. But you're right. There's a lot of active research going on across the country. So the Department of Energy funded different teams across the country to look at different geographic areas. And we were tasked with looking at this Utah and Western Colorado region, but there is also an Appalachian Basin team. There's a Powder River Basin team in Wyoming. There's teams all over the country looking at this. And then there actually are investors in Wyoming that are looking at moving forward with these operations there.
Okay, so Lauren, what are you finding in terms of rare earth elements so far in those coal seams? If you look up what are the rare earth elements most used in EVs, for example, you know, neodymium, dysprosium, terbium, I'm sure I mispronounced all of those, but you know, what are we hoping to find and what have we found?
Yeah, so we do have some of those on our list. It's neodymium, praseodymium, dysprosium. Those are certainly very critical ones as we move into clean, those are designated as clean energy important ones. And so those are ones that we are actually finding in some cases, not all cases, in some cases in potentially high enough amount to be separated and used. Now, the thing that we don't understand yet is where exactly is the resource viable? And what resource volume is there? And so our future work is really focused. We're writing a proposal now to try to really understand the variability in the resource and where it could potentially be economic.
Could you explain and clarify? I know that lithium and cobalt are not considered rare earth elements, but that may be something that you're also looking for, and maybe those are more readily available.
Yeah, so there's this broad bucket term called critical minerals. Lithium, cobalt, and different rare earth elements are in that broader bucket of critical minerals. And then so rare earth elements is a subset of critical minerals. So lithiums, so interestingly, we need all of those things, but geologically, they're found in very different settings. And so sometimes, you know, we're not going to find all the critical minerals together. So right now we're looking at rare earths and coal. We'll also, you know, we've also looked at germanium, which is not a rare earth, gallium. But for instance, so it's kind of an interesting puzzle to put together the different geologic resources that we could get lithium from versus where we could get cobalt from. We're not finding lithium. We're not finding a lot of cobalt in these particular deposits.
Well, Lauren, let's talk about the whole coal mining process and how it would relate to rare earth element extraction, because a lot of us think of coal mines as big open pit. They've scoured off the top layer. They've piled it somewhere far away. And then they dig out the coal until they hit the bottom of that seam. If the layers that contain these potential rare earth elements are top and bottom, we've already removed half of the potential layer. Is there a way to actually go back and extract from the layer that's already been dug up and piled someplace else?
Yeah, so you have some great questions. So first of all, the model that you were describing is an above ground mine or an open pit mine. And those are quite common, say, in Wyoming. However, in Utah and Western Colorado, almost all the mines are underground, actually. So we haven't removed everything above. But you're right, in a model where there's an open pit mine, yes, that's called waste, right? We've put it somewhere. We could go mine that waste. And that is an aspect that we're looking at and evaluating too. And then for an underground mine in Utah and Colorado, there, Western Colorado, there is still waste. that comes out of those mines that we've been evaluating. There's also, you know, those eventually go to the power plant, and the power plant has ash piles, right? So we've been looking at some of those ash piles as well for their viability for resources. So you make some really good points and things that we're definitely investigating.
Well, this seems like it could be such a great monetary win for the companies that run the coal mines. You said that you're possibly getting resource from the Department of Energy, I think it is?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Have any of these coal mine owners been willing to step up and help fund this as well? Because again, that could be another revenue stream for them that could be less environmentally damaging.
Yes. So the funding that we get from the U.S. Department of Energy, the Department of Energy provides 80% of the funding. 20% has to be a cost share. Usually that comes from universities or, you know, the actual research institutes, but we also often partner with industry to do that. So for instance, for our project, we have had an industry cost share partner that has provided a bit of funding kick in here and there to match it. Because there is some value added, right? We're doing research, we're bringing those results back to the coal companies. So we've been really fortunate too that all the coal companies have been, you know, they've really been great partners in letting us sample the analyses, working with us on the results and that sort of thing.
Lauren, you are at the University of Utah, and I believe, just wagering as just a guess here, that the closest mine to the University of Utah is indeed not a coal mine, but a copper mine, Kennecott.
Yes.
And of course, copper is a critical element. So why coal mines and not copper mines?
Yeah, good question. I think it's all on the table, Lynn. I think that there's a push, as I said, these different critical minerals are found in different geologic settings, right? So there's only sort of so much we can do with one research project, but there are lots of different research projects, and there's a lot of active interest in other research projects here at University of Utah and other universities looking at things like copper waste. The next proposal that we're writing now is looking at copper and cobalt, teaming with some partners at Colorado School of Mines. And so I think, you know, there's a great, we're looking at it all is the short answer. In fact, we get to sort of look at all the different types of deposits, including Rio Tinto.
Okay. And do you have the statistic about what we here in America consume in terms of, you know, whether it's phones or EVs or whatever it is that contain critical minerals, and the, you know, as compared to what we actually mine here, process, and are in our supply chain right here at home?
So in terms of our critical minerals, and specifically, I guess, rare earths, about 80% of rare earths come from China. So Mountain Pass, California is the only rare earth mine in the U.S. that's open, and it produces, you know, a small percentage of our needs. We also don't have any critical mineral rare earth processing. So actually what is mined in California goes to China for processing and comes back. So there's a huge supply chain issue going on, in that we're using all of this technology. Every phone we pick up, every screen has a critical mineral in it. Yet a very small portion of that is supplied here domestically.
Let's continue on this processing idea. What does the processing of a rare earth mineral look like? I mean, we've all seen, again, the coal mining, you bring it out, you burn it. But how do we extract these rare earth elements from all of the shale and ash?
Yeah, the short answer is I'm the geoscientist, so I try not to worry too much about that, but I partner with really great material science and metallurgical engineers that tackle that problem. So this project that I've been working on is co-led, the leader of this project is Mike Free. He's a material science engineer at University of Utah. And so the short answer is there's different density separations that you can do to get these heavy minerals out and sort of separated from the rest of the rock. And then there are different chemical separations that can happen, similar to any other sort of mining technology as well, like what's done at Rio Tinto.
As you've been out there looking at these levels of rare earth elements, have you found a high enough concentration to actually warrant this further excavation and research?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's, I can't say yes. I can't, you know, we've only been doing this research for 2 years when we started. There are only 88 data points across all of Utah and Western Colorado, but now we have 11,000. And that sounds like a lot, but it's not enough to really delineate the actual volume of the resource. So we have a lot of, you know, we have some excitement and some promise and some definite areas where we can focus future work. But I can't say, yes, we're ready to go on a resource yet.
Lauren, can you go a little deeper into the actual process you employ to find these critical minerals, X-ray fluorescent device?
Yeah. So we go out in the field. That may mean visiting a mine and going underground and taking samples. It may mean visiting a waste pile and taking samples. We also look at cores in a core warehouse that have been taken, which are really valuable. And what we do is we either take samples home, or if we're in a core warehouse, we'll actually use this little device. It's a gun. It's about this big. It's about as big as maybe, I don't know, a big water gun. And you can basically just hold the device to the rock for about 2 minutes, and it's non-destructive, and it gives you a pretty basic estimation of the concentration of lots of different elements, not just rare earths, but we've been focused mostly on rare earths. And then we do that over and over again, 2 minutes times, you know, lots of time. And then we look at the data and we pick a certain number of samples that look pretty enriched. We'll send them for what's called ICP-MS, inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. We have a great lab here at University of Utah. It takes about 2 months to process those samples and analyze them. You have to actually grind them. You have to burn them. You have to put them under hydrofluoric acid to get rid of some of the minerals we don't want. And then only after about 2 months, we get a result of a full concentration of all the rare earth elements that are in that sample. So as you can imagine, we can do the X-ray fluorescence analyses quick, dirty, get it done, just sort of put your head down. The ICP-MS analyses take quite a bit more time.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. It sounds hopeful, but it also sounds, you know, kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack.
It can be, yeah. Yeah, it can be.
I'm wondering about the environmental degradation that a coal mine produces. So on the one hand, it sounds really great to go back into existing mines, mm-hmm. instead of just mining untouched earth. On the other hand, you wonder, you know, how much mining has already occurred on one spot that it creates, you know, so much environmental degradation that you don't want to mine there anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good question. I think generally it's a trade-off, right? And it's sort of a societal question, right? That we have to grapple with, because if we need these minerals for the things we want to use, how would we best do that? And I think there's a general consensus that if the mine is already open, it's under good working order, that's a better option than opening an entirely new mine that has sort of a landscape impact. The other advantage, you know, the Utah and Colorado mines are underground, so there isn't much of a surface impact there, which is a potential advantage as well. It doesn't mean there aren't other impacts and other risks, but, you know, I think in general, most people would agree that, you know, if we're talking about expanding an existing mine is preferable to opening a new one in terms of the impact.
Lauren, on your bio page for the University of Utah, I was reading that you focus on cross collaboration between disciplines. And we've already talked about Michael Free from the Materials Science Department. And we'd love to understand all of the pieces that come into these big projects.
Yeah.
Who else, what other programs and departments are involved with you in this?
Yeah, so Mike Free has been my main collaborator. We've also been working with folks at University of Utah in the Mining Engineering Department that were on this project in earlier phases. Much of the funding went towards actually just characterizing the resource. So our geology team was able to really just dig in there. But we have some great expertise on the project in the Mining Engineering Department as well. Because you're right, it's a supply chain issue. So we have to actually address all the parts.
Well, our guest today has been Dr. Lauren Bergenheier. She is Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah and also a co-author on a paper talking about the possibility of extracting rare earth elements from existing coal mines. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We're excited to see where this goes.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
You've been listening to KPCW's Cool Science Radio. Tune in next week to Cool Science Radio. We will talk about the early 1900s astronomer Henrietta Leavitt, who expanded our understanding of the universe by paying attention to glass plate photographs of the stars. And then we talk with U of U chemist Louisa Whitaker Brooks about her research of ultra-thin electronics materials and nanoscale circuits. That's next week here on Cool Science Radio.